Hey everybody, believe it or not, it's time for another crew call. This one's 5-4, and here we are in September 2024. Prior to this, I looked it up, and sure enough, my last podcast that we recorded was with it was Dave Owens and I, and it was back in April of 2024. So obviously, I've got some splaining to do here, and there's no better person to hold my feet to the fire than Scotty Mason, who we have on the show as a returning.
Boo, hiss, boo.
Hey Scott, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. How are you?
I'm not bad, and I want to give Scott 100% of the credit for taking out the jumper cables and hooking them up to my temples and reminding me that, yeah, we do a podcast once in a while.
Yeah, this needed to be done. You can't, I didn't step aside so that you could not do this anymore. So, I
I
mean,
thought
if
you
I have
stepped
to
aside to become a professional baseball player.
Tell that to my shoulder.
Right. Well, we're gonna talk about our body parts. There'll be a scintillating part of the podcast for sure. Because basically Scott's got some questions for me, and we're gonna see if I have answers.
Yeah, Mike's got some splaining to do, folks.
I got some explaining to do.
Mike just dumped this Crestwood addition to the layout on us. It came out of the blue. There was no Mike, I've been over your house twice in the fairly recent past,
Sure.
and there's been no leak of this information. I would consider us to be fairly close friends and confidants, and but yet it completely took me by surprise. I felt like I got blackjacked in the back of the head. And I'm looking at this thing, I'm like, this is not supposed to happen. I'm happy it is, but this goes against everything that you had kind of laid down as the gospel when you built the addition to the house. You had figured out the plan for the space. You had figured out everything that was non-model railroad and where it was going. And then all of a sudden, by the way, this reeks of Mike Confalone.
I was just thinking about him while you were saying all that.
Here's Crestwood. So, start from the beginning of, Crestwood kind of formulating in your head and how that all came about.
So, all right. So much of what you just said is not quite right. So I'm going to try to explain.
Never is.
Try to explain why that's the case. So, first of all, Crestwood was always in the plan. It's the last Conrail section of the layout that was undone. I think when you were here last, you may have done the Jenkins local, right? Didn't you do the 84 lumber and the
Yes, correct.
refrigerated warehouse? Well, that local rather, continues on to Crestwood and it has business there. And basically, that local spends, the whole day working not just Jenkins but also everything else in Crestwood. And in fact, it takes Jenkins and does part of it on the way and then the other part of it on the way back because of a facing point, trailing point situation there, as you know. So
Gotcha, yep.
doing Crestwood in the former oil tank room, the room I had laboriously drilled a hole in my foundation to access, that was always in the cards. So the real question is, what changed, if anything, and why now? So, when I got done with Piston Junction, and then I moved on to the little adjacent area of the Pocono Northeast, or PNE, as we always refer to it, off to the right of that, basically all of the contiguous layout was. I guess I don't want to say done because the layout's never done, but it was all presentable. I like to use the word presentable. I could run trains through it and show it to people and not feel like I had to apologize for anything, right? So plenty of detailing and improvements to be made, which is how I plan to spend my older age. I can't say old age because I'm already there, right? Once you're care and Social Security and all of that stuff, there's no sense denying it, right? I just turned
No, nope.
68 this summer for the public record. So
The next thing I started to try to figure out was, what did I want to do specifically on that long wall as you walk in opposite Pittston Yard? It's a big, long wall. It's about 22 feet long, not very wide. So I talked to a lot of people just to get some technique conversations going, because when you shift gears from, you know, modeling in ample room, and now you're modeling in quite a bit less than ample room, I can't say that I have a great deal of experience with that, because, you know, I've always had ample room everywhere I've done something. So this was kind of a, I would say the P&E portion of the layout was probably the least planned out aspect of the entire layout. I knew I wanted to do it. I knew it was important to the overall operations, but there's also kind of like a paucity of information on the P&E as compared to what I had for Conrail and even the D&H.
Sure, stands to reason.
I mean, the Conrail layout is largely prototypically researched, among other ways, out of the ZTS diagrams that Conrail had, which were very detailed and really exactly what you'd want if you were doing prototype modeling of a segment or a few segments of a prototype main line. And even, I mean, because it's right down to the sidings, it's right down to the spots. It shows you the consignees. It's unbelievable, really. It's everything. And I think Conrail did it in part because when they looked at everything they had to digest, they basically said, you know what, we need this information if we're going to try to run this railroad. And they basically documented everything. And I had been working off of a 1990 ZTS for the beginning. And then I was able to source a 1985 ZTS, at least for the division that I'm modeling, from another fellow, Olaf Tarme, who's a very well-known railroad photographer. And he was kind enough to send me his, and I scanned the entire thing and digitized it and printed it and sent it back to him with many things.
Hey, Mike, for those of us, I'm sorry to interrupt. For those of us who don't know, what does ZTS stand for?
Zone, track, spot.
And what exactly is that?
So if you think of the zone, that would be the division. So Albany division, New Jersey division, that kind of thing. New England division, right? Conrail had a bunch of divisions.
Yep.
And then every track has a number within that division. And then every consignee has a spot, right? Or multiple spots. So the ZTS is to show, it's something that any crew member, any administrator, any manager can just look up a particular area, a particular customer, and get all the information about what the physical plant exists as.
I see. And how far back in time did that go? When was its origin?
I honestly don't know when the first ZTS was. I want to say they started to appear in the 80s, right? Because when you think about when Conrail took over, it took them a while to get their arms around the scope of the whole thing, right? It was gigantic railroad.
Go figure.
Gigantic roster.
Gigantic mess.
Yeah, yeah. So the fact that they were able to, in the space of maybe, I don't know, 3-4 years maybe, when they started to get it together, that's a tremendous amount of work in that time. So
yeah,
it's really a credit to the people who took over and didn't exhibit the old Penn Central, New York Central, us versus them thing, right? That's what doomed Penn Central in part.
Sure.
So Conrail didn't have that, at least not to the degree that poor Penn Central did. And I think this kind of information and the fact that it exists is part of the proof of that, right? I've looked for stuff like this on the Delaware and Hudson and come completely empty with it, you know. So a lot of my D&H info comes from, you know, talking to former employees and even some Conrail people who actually interacted with the D&H, which is really my main concern anyway, you know, because it's not a DNH layout, but there's a chunk of the DNH that Conrail in my area interacted with, interchanged with, had trackage rights on.
Yep.
So it made sense to include the DNH on my layout. And I would say the same thing about the Pocono Northeast, because the Pocono Northeast roamed all over the place. They had some of their own tracks. They ran on Conrail. They ran on the DNH. And really a very interesting, shoddy little operation, really. You know, I mean, they would spend all day trundling around at 10 mile an hour, risking life and limb on some of that trackage. And in servicing a pretty wide customer base back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just winding back just a little bit, I went to the Malvern meet in March.
Yes.
And I did my clinic at that time. And I hadn't been there in, I want to say, maybe 4 years, right? So the clinic was really catching people up on what I had done in the last 4 years. You know, it was a pretty good sized PowerPoint. And at the beginning of that, I always ask, was anybody here at my last clinic 4 years ago? And a surprising amount of hands go up, right? So
it's. You mean they were still there?
Yeah, they were waiting patiently.
Ah, okay.
But they were clearly, I guess, following along with things. And I like to go to that meet in part because it's in my modeling territory or close enough to it. So I think there's a lot of local interest in the subject that I've chosen to model, right? So after the clinic was over, several people came up, which is typical after any clinic, right? And chatted it up with me. One guy was a former Conrail engineer who had all kinds of interesting anecdotes for me. But one guy that chatted up with me was named Paul Rice, and he worked for the Pocono Northeast back in the day.
Oh, no kidding.
And Paul had provided to me some years back several pictures and just a really well done spreadsheet that showed all of the P&E consignees and what they got for car loadings and the frequency and where they were and all of that. So that was gold to me because it's really hard to find this information. And it kind of shows you how one person can make a huge difference when you're building a relatively obscure prototype, you know?
Yep, absolutely.
So, and Paul had been kind enough to answer questions back and forth occasionally. He's on the crew call group, right? He's on this podcast group on Facebook. So sometimes he'll just chime in with something amazing and you just think, wow, you know, so he is following along with things. Really mm-hmm. nice guy. As we were trying to figure out what we wanted to do on the remaining P&E section, two different things happened. So one of them, the easy one that I'll talk about, is that Ken McCrory, you know Ken McCrory.
Sure. Sure.
Guy with the world's largest quote unquote home layout down in the Downington, Pennsylvania there. Super nice guy, helped me a bunch. He rang me up on the phone of all things and said that he and Paul would like to stop by and visit the layout prior to Springfield this coming year. So I said, absolutely, because we've been trying to arrange Ken to stop by anyway. And with Paul of P&E fame included in that, I just thought, well, might be premature to start doing any advanced planning without talking to Paul in person, with him seeing the layout, seeing the space available, talking through some things that might not come up just in an email kind of exchange. You know what I mean? I'll have my buddy Dave Santos there as well. So that became something that we decided to postpone any drastic planning or concrete planning for the P&E.
Okay.
Now, at the same time, we had been having these discussions about next steps, you know, and I have to admit that the reason the oil tank room hasn't been done yet is that every time I looked at it, I came up empty. It's a 9 by 10-ish sort of a space. So it's big enough to do something interesting in, but small enough that you got to be careful. You got to be very careful because you don't want to, you know, you don't want a Magaga bag, if you know what that is.
I've been accused of that.
Sure. So Dave and I have literally been kicking around ideas for Crestwood in the former oil tank room there for years, you know. And I've said this a million times, if I can't see it in my head, I can't build it, right? If I can't picture it, I can't build it. So because we had this sort of built-in lull, well, where we decided to consciously wait on doing anything, you know, concrete, like I said, on the Pocono Northeast, I thought, well, let's take a look at Crestwood again and see if we can't think this through. Now, I want you to remind me, in case we get sidetracked, to circle back to the Pocono Northeast when I'm done with Crestwood, because there's more on that.
Okay.
So it's not just what I'm talking about here. So, so Dave and I started actually in earnest talking about Crestwood. He came over, and you know how Dave is. He just, you know, I liken it to, I feed information into the Dave computer, and then he kind of chews on it. And he just,
Dave is a very serious, sober individual, and
with a
great sense of humor. But if you ask him to think about something,
yep,
boy, he's going to analyze it six ways to Sunday.
He'll actually do the work, you know, and yeah. He's kind of like, you know, if I'm talking to you about an issue or Confalone or any of the other guys, it's usually like a heavily interactive stuff. David's a little different. You dump all of this data into him, and then it's like one of those 1960s mainframes. You know what I mean? Like, you can hear the relays clicking, you know, and nothing comes out for a while, you know. But I've learned to just leave them alone, you know. And then he'll just invariably stand there and say, "Why don't you just do blah blah blah?" And you just look at him like, how do you do it? You know what I mean? So at one of these early conversations, I fed a bunch of stuff into the Dave computer, and he said, you know, it'd be a lot easier to do Crestwood if he just moved Monroton to the other side of the wall, into the model shop. And that's when I looked at him and I thought, really?
Bingo.
Now Monroton, just by way of background, is the one industry that the TMSL, which is the Towanda Monroton Shippers Lifeline, which is another little short line that connects to Conrail in Towanda. You've probably worked it.
I have.
So you know what I'm talking about. They just have a little SW1 in kind of like a Lehigh Valley homage paint scheme. And they trundle back and forth to Monroton with one or two grain hoppers. That's their whole reason for being. And the grain mill itself is actually a very cool, very interesting, highly original grain mill that I can't wait to build. So I really wanted to have that someplace. And up until I talked with Dave, it was going to be sort of at the entrance to the Crestwood area in the former oil tank room at a higher level, you know, and it wasn't going to be any Conrail under it. But you'd walk by it as you went into that area. And I realized at that point that that's really what was constraining thinking about it as a whole. It was like this thing that was sort of part of it. And really, if you took it out of there, it changed your whole perspective on what could happen in the room. So You may have noticed on the group my documentation of the tunneling efforts to get from oil tank room into the model shop.
Sure.
And there was no small effort involved in clearing out that area of the model shop to accommodate Monroton being there. Because
of course, yeah.
There were tall cabinets on that wall. There was a big pegboard full of all of my styrene parts. Something else too that, oh, the charging station with all of the cordless tools and battery chargers and all that stuff. I mean, it was just chock-a-block full of stuff.
Sure.
So when he said that, and I instantly realized that that was the obvious solution, I then had to get my computer going and figure out how the heck I was going to do all of that. And that caused me to basically say, well, if I got to clear out this area, it needs to go someplace. Well, the functions that are there need to go someplace. And really, it ended up causing me to look at my workshop, my woodworking shop, and do a big remodeling of the woodworking shop to get rid of stuff that really was just wasting space and not very efficient and taking up room, and move some things that were in that spot into the woodworking shop so I could create an area for my room. So that was actually a pretty big project this summer, you know?
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, from about mid-May to, about mid-May to about the second week of July, I had a huge IT project that was just kind of thrust upon me. My biggest, oldest customer was selling out. They were getting out of their business and selling out to somebody else, and they weren't going to need me, but there was a tremendous amount of work to be done to bring about this whole transition. And early in the process, I realized that the acquiring party wasn't remotely interested in project managing this. So I ended up doing it myself. And they were on a little bit looser ship than my former customer. So that took up a lot of CPU cycles during all that time. So that's partly why there were no podcasts during that time. And then also in my spare time, I was trying to get this whole workshop redo and clearing out space for Monroton and get that built thing going on. And all of a sudden, after all of that, I started considering myself semi-retired, because that customer took up a lot of my hours in the course of a week.
Mm-hmm.
So with them gone, you would think that I would have like all kinds of free time to act like a semi-retired person.
Yeah.
But the reality is, when you get to be an old fella, you know, we've got all of our kids, and now our kids have kids. So it's like all of a sudden we have this giant family. So the summer has been like the summer of grandchildren. Went to Florida to see Jay and company down there, and the New Yorkers were coming up here, two different visits, and next thing you know, it's September, and I've got Scott Mason knocking on my electronic door saying, "Hey, we need to do a podcast, because you know, if I don't get you to do it, I guess you're not going to do it," which is kind of true.
Well, it felt like there was a void. I didn't necessarily know what was causing it. It just felt like there was a disturbance in the universe and we needed to correct it.
Well, you know, if you look back, I think the same kind of thing happened last summer too. I think I kind of took the summer off, you know, the summer of Mike, I guess.
Sure.
And
to a degree, that's to be expected.
It's just, I didn't factor in. Oh, another thing that happened during all of this, my son bought a house in Florida. So
yes,
there was a whole big rigmarole surrounding that, because everything's a project, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's really why I ended up going down to, South Florida in July. Ask me how that was.
It was probably about the same as the Arizona-Mexico border at the beginning of August.
That's like, what you were?
108 degrees.
But it's a dry heat, which you can't say about Florida.
Yeah. Okay. So it was a convection oven. But I wouldn't want to bake in it.
Can I ask you what the heck you were doing there?
Yeah, I have a client that is headquartered up here in Massachusetts that has their major manufacturing in Nogales, Mexico, and their major distribution center in Nogales, Arizona. So they just bought a new DC down there.
Yep.
Excuse me.
Distribution center in the parlance.
Yeah, and they needed me to come down and start working on a plan to fill it with pallet rack and automated retrieval systems. So I spent a couple of really hot days down there. But you know, I'm just a
couple of days, really.
Yeah, they're business trips, they're quick trips, and quite frankly, you know, I don't know that I would want to spend a prolonged amount of time. I'll be going back down there when the project gets implemented.
Yeah.
But I'm like you. I'm probably semi-retired or close to it. And, you know, I'm looking at the light at the end of the tunnel here. And I'm getting a little weary of plane travel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have systematically wrung out any resemblance to fun that it may have once had.
Well, in the past 6 months, I've had two aborted landings, including one where we had wheels on the runway
and
took off again. And the last flight or the last trip, we had an aborted takeoff because we had a bird strike.
Wow.
Yeah. And so
it's like the great magnet is trying to tell you something.
Well, you know, I heard a ka-thud, and jeez, the pilot shut the plane down real quick. And when he did, I thought, my first thought was, how much runway do we have left?
What airport was this?
Green in Providence.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Now, I haven't had any of those adventures. I was talking more of the, you know, bus with wings aspect, that airline travel.
Well, there's that too. And, you know, there's the plague that you inevitably, you know, come down with as a result of either being on the plane or being in the airport.
Hey, in an airport and a plane, I'm still wearing a mask. I don't care.
Yeah. And, you know, like you, I've got, you know, my own interests, modeling interests here and you know, all that stuff kind of detracts from it.
Remind me of your advancing age now.
Yes, it is. I will be 62 in December.
62. Okay. So you're on my side of the fence, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm on your side of the ground too, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely a high priority for me on a daily basis.
Yeah. 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 So let me ask you, and we've, over the years, we've talked a lot about the planning process and how it applies to whether it's a model railroad in general or a new addition on a model railroad, and where you've got a relatively small space to work with on this part of the project. Were you planning around specific structures and industries, or were you trying to squeeze operation in and kind of backfilling what was going to be operated? What was your focus on that? What was your approach?
Well, that's the right question. Those are the right questions. Now, you also work the Kaiser Valley Industrial Park here?
Yes.
Okay. So the process is very similar to what I went through with the Kaiser Valley, because, as you know, industrial parks tend to be big and spread out, and the buildings tend to be similarly so, right? But what you're looking for is representing enough of the structure that it justifies the traffic that goes to it. And you want the traffic because that's what makes it interesting to operate, part of your overall operational scheme. So Crestwood Industrial Park was something that my buddy Tony V, the Reading and Northern engineer, he had given Dave and I a really detailed tour of the entire area a couple of times, actually. And Crestwood being no exception. So Crestwood has...
Can I stop you for just a second?
Sure.
For those who don't know, myself included, where is Crestwood specifically in Pennsylvania?
Do you know where Mountaintop is?
No.
Okay. So picture you're at Pittston Junction.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're on the south or eastbound main, the Lehigh Valley Mountain cutoff, which is what they built to get to Pittston without going through Wilkes-Barre.
Yeah.
Better grades and all of that. It makes like a big loop through the mountains. So it's like literally going the wrong way to eventually go the right way, if that's the way I can explain it. So
gotcha.
You know, you're going to end up eventually in Allentown, but as you make this big loop, you're climbing and climbing and climbing through the mountains. And I think the first peak you get to is appropriately named Mountaintop. And okay. The Crestwood Industrial Park is like, I'll call it the next exit. Okay. South of that. So basically you come off the main line and there's a steep grade down. Now, do you remember seeing any pictures back in the day, probably like the early 90s, I would say, of locomotives being remanufactured at Morrison Knudsen?
Yeah.
Okay. So that plant is in the Crestwood Industrial Park.
Okay.
In my era, it wasn't MK yet. It was Foster Wheeler. And Foster Wheeler made all kinds of heavy industrial things, and they had multiple plants all over the place. This one, from what I can tell, made, among other things, pressure vessels, like these really high pressure rounded end things with stuff sticking out all over them that they'd stick on a flat car and send out of there on occasions.
Okay.
It was pressure vessels. And I'm trying to think what the other thing was. The other thing they made there escapes me right now. And part of it is that information on this facility is extremely scarce and hard to come by. Mm. Every once in a while, just I think it was either yesterday or the day before, Dave and I stumbled upon a picture with a Facebook image search, single solitary picture of the whole facility from the air, which I've never seen. And we just looked at that and thought, wow, looked like it was maybe when it was being built in the late 50s. You know, it was that kind of a deal.
Okay.
It's a pretty big structure. What had caught my eye was on the ZTS, the track arrangement is just amazing. That's the only way I mean, the only thing that's probably more complicated would be Mahoopany. So
really?
Yeah. So it's got trackage on both ends of the building. I'm assuming this is raw materials in, finished goods out.
More than likely.
There's an explosives building that's separate from everything, understandably. There's an X-ray shed where they used to X-ray finished products, I guess, out in this other building.
Sure, for leaks, cracks and leaks.
Yeah, they must have had either a plant switcher or a track mobile or something to do these interplant moves, but all of the trackage did connect to the outside world. So it wasn't like any of it was captive. Yeah. So you've got this big sprawling facility with really interesting stuff on either end and a big nondescript middle, which I'm going to selectively condense and try to get it to still look enormous without resorting to putting on another addition, you know what I mean? So, so because of the interest level of the traffic, I mean, you have to figure a place like that definitely got plate steel in. They have a couple of tracks outdoors that have these big overhead cranes, and the tracks are in a concrete pad. So that had to be raw materials like steel coming in.
They sure.
Had, you know, tank cars of argon and oxygen, I'm guessing, for welding purposes.
Mm-hmm.
An occasional boxcar of explosives and flat car loads, like heavy duty flat car loads on the other side of finished product that would go out. I've got a few pictures of these loads, first car on the train kind of deal, head out, you know.
Sure.
So imagine, you know, picking up a load like that and hauling it all the way back to Pittston, and then it gets picked up by, you know, one of the road freights in Pittston. I mean, just to me, it just adds a lot of interest and variety to the whole thing. So I really wanted to incorporate Foster Wheeler. And then the other big one there is CertainTeed. And CertainTeed made, I want to say, roofing materials.
Yes.
So they had granules in and shipped out in boxcars. CertainTeed in Crestwood is out of business, but the entire place is there mothballed, just like stuffed and mounted. It's incredible. It's like,
no kidding.
It's like, you know, life after humans when you look at it. You
yeah.
know, perfectly preserved. And so I've got some really good pictures of that, and also some really harrowing descriptions of operating it, because it's like a 5% downgrade to get into the plant on an 18-inch radius curve.
Wow.
And they would literally grease the rails. Like by hand.
Or why would they do that?
I guess as you get into more modern and longer cars, the
oh, I see. Just to navigate the curves.
Yeah, pretty sharp curvature. Or maybe they were doing it. It might have been a locomotive thing. Maybe they were using a bigger instead of an SW8 pup. Maybe they were using a GP38 or a U23B or something. You know what I mean? I don't have hard info as to the whys on that yet. But I told my friend Tony V, I said, well, one thing I'm not going to model is a 5% grade going down into that thing, because grades don't scale well on a model railroad.
Yeah, it's
interesting. Really, really hard to switch that place out on a sharp curve. And a
oh, grade. Good, you know, God, yeah.
You know, just having, I mean, you run into that a little bit in Jenkins if you don't spot your,
yeah,
your cut just,
it's
right.
It's gonna roll away on you.
So
yep.
We don't have the luxury of setting the brakes on these things without resorting to hokey procedures, you know, like wheel chocks and things. So I decided I was gonna do it relatively flat. But again, the plant is really interesting looking. It's got a cool looking concrete, big rectangular silo that the tracks go underneath, and a couple of sidings that they load through to load the cars. So it would be a nice traffic generator. And I think it would do, you could see how it could take up, like, say, the back wall of the former oil tank room and do it justice. You know what I mean? So
I see. Yep.
We concluded that can go there. And then the other weirdo thing about it is, and I've yet to get an explanation of why this would be, you can picture how you'd have a straight track and a couple of turnouts for a runaround siding, right? What this place has is two equilateral Y turnouts for that purpose, which I've never seen before.
Okay. Wow.
So you know, and we're looking
like at what difference?
Go ahead.
I mean, why? I guess I'm at a loss for words. I'm never at a loss for words, Mike. No, I'm trying to picture that in my head. I've never seen that before.
Well, none of us had ever seen that before. And it's such an interesting aspect of the prototype that, you know, Tony V and Dave looked at me and said, you got to model this. And I'm thinking, how am I going to do that? You know, but weirdly, Walther's has just come out with their own line of, to me, it looks like imitation Pico turnouts.
Uh-huh.
I liked all of the features that they talked about. Like they took everything that was good about a Pico and replicated it, but they've got a lot more options. So, for example, they have a bit sharper curved turnout that I'm going to need in a couple of areas. So rather than mangle a Pico, I'm going to try a couple of these Walthers. And they have a number 3 Y turnout, which is about the same size as a Pico, but also number 4, which is really what I need. It's less pronounced in the in the divergence. So and they let you print out the PDFs of the turnout. So as soon as I printed out the PDF and looked at it, I said, yep, that's the turnout I need. So I'll be getting a couple of those, and we figured out how we were going to incorporate that. And then there's a couple of lesser industries that kind of flesh out the industrial park. One of them is a plastics. They do something. I don't know what they make, but they take a couple of pellet cars. And then the other one is a manufactured home builder. So basically, they'll get center beams and bulkhead flats of kind of just like 84 Lumber does and a lot of other places on the layout. So I have everything I need to service both of those industries. More importantly, it gives it more of a full industrial park feel than if you only did the two industries. You know what I mean? So we figured out a way to do the four out of, I think, a total of five there that are rail served in my era. We figured out how to do four and not have it be too congested. So that's really where we just kind of left it. And as a matter of fact, as of yesterday, I figured out materials I need to order, and I'm going to have at it.
So we should be operating in a couple of weeks.
Well, not a couple of weeks, but we will be operating that, I would think, before the end of the year, because what I like to do is get the track down, nothing permanent, run it for a while, like a few months if need be. I did that with Kaiser Valley. I think I ran it without scenery or structures for almost a year, I think. I was doing other stuff. And that experience of doing that told me that my runaround needed to be longer. My tail track could be shorter. I had one too many consignees, so I removed one. You know what I mean? And then after that, I was completely, completely happy with it, you know? So I anticipate the same kind of deal in Crestwood. Although, in a way, Crestwood has, it seems to have more real estate, you know, than Kaiser Valley did. So I think it's going to be just fine, you know. And the other thing was, the debate for that room had always been, okay, one big peninsula that you walk around, or the usual around the walls bench work, you know. And I could have made a case for each. And the other option for that room, there was a third consignee called Technoglass that back in the day, believe it or not, they made TV picture tubes.
Wow. Okay.
And it was a huge facility, and they got those two bay ACF hoppers of sand,
mm-hmm.
like from the Winchester and Western kind of
sure.
area, as raw materials in, and they shipped out picture tubes in boxcars like crazy. It's nothing but a smudge on the landscape now, but that was a very cool place that I had a lot of trouble once again getting information about, until somehow I stumbled upon a video that showed the demolition of the plant. And it was actually well done. I think it was obviously shot with a drone. And they basically showed the entire facility prior to demolition. So what I was able to do was, you know, show it over and over, pause it, take screenshots. And I ended up with very, very good pictures of the entire plant, which is hard to do. But that would have been a really big scope of operations. And I probably would have had to detour the main line around it. And the more we looked at it, the more I said, you know, even though you're putting one thing in this room, it's going to feel cramped, I think.
Yep.
Because, you know, one of the things you got to keep very much in mind if you operate is people movement. You know, how are humans going to walk around this space, interact with everything that's there? Are the turnouts within reach? What are your operational issues? And now that we've done a lot of operating, I've got a much better feel of that. So I looked at the space, looked at the reaches and all of that, and basically we tossed up some bench work in a week that reflected plenty of space and ample room to access it all, you know? So that's kind of what you saw as the frenzy of construction over the last couple of weeks here. It doesn't take long to put up 25 lineal feet of bench work and the topping, you know, for it.
Sure.
Not like you're building a mountainous area that's going to have all kinds of grades and all of that kind of thing. So
sure.
So really, and then the other planning has just been, you know, okay, and what are the buildings going to look like, and what do I need to build those and all of that. So because of the conversations surrounding possible use of parts of the model shop for model railroad purposes, because the model shop is pretty big. I used to do everything on one workbench, you know?
It's a pretty luxurious space you've got down there.
It is, you know, and I kept looking at my workshop thinking, boy, it's a good thing the workshop is not on the same level, because the workshop floor is, I think, 22 inches higher.
Yeah.
So you can't do anything useful model railroading wise, even if you carved out part of the workshop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or so I thought. I'm getting.
Well, yeah, I know where this is going, but go ahead.
No, you don't.
Okay.
Because this is fresh off the printing presses as of yesterday.
Okay.
So, but then when I thought about it, I thought, well, the only other area available that's at the same floor level is the model shop, right? So what I basically decided was, if I keep the outside of the model, the outside wall, rather, of the model shop pretty much as it is, which is DCC installs, paint booth, and the locomotive storage cabinet. And that pretty much is going to remain as it is. And it's separated from the walkway path by the door to the outside and the walk path to the workshop and all of that.
Yep.
But everything on the other side is like fair game. So that's where the P&E expansion into the model shop is going to be.
Okay.
I already have the mouse hole through the wall to that little staging yard I built anyway. So basically there's going to be a peninsula of shape and size to be determined in that room.
Okay.
And I don't want to have too many preconceived notions about it until my Pennsylvanians come up and we have a discussion about it. Plenty to do in the meantime. But so that sounds like we're done talking about that, but we're not.
No, I didn't think we were.
So here's what I want you to try to picture if you can. Do you remember in the old days before the addition, the workshop was a separate building?
Yes.
And it had as its entrance a big pair of double doors, 6 foot
open.
Okay.
Yep.
So when the addition was built and the workshop needed to be closed in, those doors came out. They closed in that opening, along with a front window opening. And I thought about that the other day. And I thought about the P&E narrowly coming down that big long wall. Now, can you picture at Mike Confalone's that sort of almost like shadow boxed area? Like you leave Madrid Yard, you take the right hand fork.
Yes.
And
yes.
And you see that area that used to be a steel mill, but it's not a steel mill anymore.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know if you've seen that or not, but you should. But that area is worth having. It's 2 feet high. It's a couple of feet deep. I think his is about, I think he said 7 feet wide. And I thought, well, that's not a load-bearing wall in that area. If I bumped out 18 inches into the workshop with a box, I could use it as a shelf in the workshop.
Yep.
And I would all of a sudden get full depth on the Pocono Northeast in a 2x6 area.
Yep.
So I think that's where I'm going to put Carbon Technologies. I think that's where that's like a really, really interesting consignee back in the day. It's going to be like a focal
point
on the P&E. So I think that's sufficient space to justify doing that. And I honestly think I can whip that up in pretty short order. It's basically going to be a big plywood box.
Well, it sounds like you've got it visualized. And like you say, you know, if you can visualize it, you can build it.
Well, the converse of that is just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. So to the extent that I've decided to do it, I've drilled two little teeny weeny pilot holes that could easily be filled in and drawn it in pencil on the wall. That's it.
Okay.
I'm going to be staring at that for a while.
Okay.
You know, I may or may not cut it open before the guys come. Don't know. I've got plenty of fun in Crestwood to keep me busy. So I don't need to open up another front. You know what I mean? So
sure. Of course.
Although you could make the argument that you might want to get the messy part of it out of the way all at once while you're doing all this other messy part and you're in that mode. So that's sort of the internal discussion that I'm having with myself on that.
And that to me indicates the differences between you and I. So I'm a ready, shoot, aim kind of guy. You're a ready, aim, pre-shoot, shoot kind of guy, which is great. And you know, the execution is phenomenal. So, you know, I'm really excited to see what you do, certainly with Crestwood. And then if you move along down and flesh out the P&E a little more, it's just another opportunity.
I think so. You know, I mean, I'm also committed in modern days to no more big layout kabooms. You know what I mean? It's just...
I'm going to write this down just to make sure. I don't know why you would.
You can etch it in stone.
No, I don't know why you would.
I'll run out of life years.
I mean, in the past, I've said, okay, this makes sense. I think if you said to me, hey, guess what? I just brought in a truckload of TNT. You know, I'd say, Mike, I really think you and I need to go get your head examined.
Yeah. The reality is I'm very happy with my layout as it stands. You know,
you should be.
It came out nice, and it has proven for me at least to be even more fun to operate than I had pictured. So
yep.
I put that in the win column. You know, I don't think I'd ever get bored running the layout, and there's plenty of fun stuff to do to it. But this heavy duty stuff does not get easier as you get older. So I'm also motivated to do the heavy duty stuff sooner than later.
Sure. Sure. Get it out of the way.
Should see me dragging sheets of homosote by myself from the tractor shed all the way down the driveway. I've got to strike all the way down the asphalt.
Well, that eventually that'll wash away.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about it. But you know, it shows you how motivated I was to kind of just be done with that.
Yeah. No, hey, I understand. And you know, I've had discussions about, you know, whether I would build another layout. And I honestly, you know, I'd never say never. But you know, at
going, I still think you have that Penn Central layout in you.
Yeah, no, I know that I do, but whether it ever comes out is another story altogether.
But see, you can't even picture what it's like to not be working full time. And if you're not, you know, that first week for you is going to be kind of weird. and don't be surprised if you say, boy, I like this. This is kind of cool. I could do this, or I could do this, or I could do this. Lots of possibilities. That was kind of like me at the end of July. I will say the first week after that big cutover, when I didn't have all the daily, you know, at me all the time stuff, it was a little disconcerting. It was like, whoa, I've got all this time. I don't want to waste it.
Well, and I'm like you, I've got plenty of other interests. So, you know, when that day gets here, I'm not going to be at a loss for things to do or things that I want to do.
Right.
You know, and again, as you know, I've been working on these museum exhibits for the Historical Museum here in Franklin.
And those are no small projects from what I've seen. How far into the future do you conceive of that continuing?
Well, I think, well, so just to back up, so this is the third one that I'm in the process of building, and each one has gotten progressively larger.
Yeah, this is the biggest one. The pictures you sent are amazing.
This is this one will be all of 11 feet by 4 feet.
Jeez.
Now,
are you talking about the scene or the building itself?
I'm talking about the scene, but it's basically the scene is two industries.
Okay.
It's back in 1932, when this is depicted, they were both textile mills. You know me, I love a challenge.
Sure.
This every inch of this year's project has been an immense challenge and a series of solving problems, not only in translating two big industries into two scale, accurately scaled models, but just the process of creating the materials that you need in order to build these buildings.
Well, this kind of goes beyond scratch building in a way. This is like manufacturing.
It's we had to do a couple of things. So first of all, I'm not alone in this endeavor. My buddy Sam Maxwell has, who's not in the hobby, but you know, loves a challenge as much as me. And this guy is the Radar O'Reilly of life. If there's a problem, he can give him 20 minutes and he'll solve it and come back with a great solution. So the first issue we had was, you know, how do you build this 32? Well, the first mill is about 32 square feet. How do you build this mill, this brick building, without losing your shirt on the cost of sheets of brick embossed or brick laser cut basswood?
And windows too, right? I mean, think of how many windows.
Oh, well, there were seven different styles of mill window in this building that all had to be measured and drawn. And then we had to figure out a way to cut them economically, hundreds and hundreds of windows.
What degree of compression are you employing for this?
0 degree of compression. It is
full scale.
It is full scale. Yeah. To the millimeter, as a matter of fact. We're not even working in inches and feet. We're working in millimeters.
Really?
Yeah. So I can attest that. And then this was actually one of the problems we encountered, and I'll get to that. But so we and I love Jimmy Simmons and I love his products, but Jimmy would have broken the bank if I had to keep buying sheets of brick. Because think about, you know, you've got a mill wall that is 4 feet long and it's got 72 windows in it. It's 90% windows and then brick arches and brick around the windows. Well, if I were buying those sheets from Jimmy, 90% of those sheets end up in the trash.
Right.
You know, at $48 a sheet.
How big a material can you work with in terms of raw materials?
That's a good question, because our laser is oversized.
Yeah.
But the constraint is that, you know, if you buy plain sheets of basswood from Northeastern Scale Lumber, they're still, the biggest they make is 6 inches by 24 inches.
Okay.
So it has less to do with the size of the laser, just what the standard product size is.
Right. But think about that now. You've only got a joint at most every 24 inches.
Exactly. And the way this building is constructed, the newer parts of the building are, which were built in the turn of the 20th century, and then the last portion of it was built in 1927, have a brick column, if you will, between each row of windows.
Okay.
So it's very easy to hide a seam if you have one.
Yep.
So Sam decided he was going to draw his own brick. And not to steal anybody's thunder, but the practice in the products that were available was to draw a 1-inch pattern of brick and then copy and paste it
right
to create the sheet. Sam drew a complete sheet of individual bricks. So that was the
Jimmy
first
one. Jimmy somehow started with a photo.
Yes. What Jimmy did was he took a photo of a brick wall.
Yep.
And then he drew it, but it was only a square inch. And then he took that square inch and he just copied it.
So even he only used the square inch. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. So it's a reoccurring pattern.
Yep.
This brick that we created is not, there's no pattern to it at all. It's just brick. So the first layer is basically what you would call new brick. Then he drew a second layer, which etches the new brick to create a little bit of weathering. Then we have an alternate third layer that we can use that creates even more weathering in the brick. So we've got some options as far as that goes. But it's so time consuming to cut brick. To cut one sheet of brick takes an hour and a half. And then you still have to go back and cut out all the window openings, all the wall sizes, all that sort of stuff.
Because that's a whole different file.
Oh, it's a whole different file. Yeah, it's three or four different files. So it's an incredibly time-consuming process.
So just as a seat of the pants estimate, how many 6x24 pieces of basswood went into this building?
30-ish. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and along the way, I may have made a mistake or two with my CAD work. So I did the initial CAD work, sent it to him. He checked it, refined it, did some of the more intense stuff that you know, I don't have the ability to do. But everything that existed and by the way, both of these mills still exist today. So that's the good news. Unlike most of the previous two exhibits, which are buildings that are no longer around,
yep.
And I was strictly relegated to modeling from photographs, I can go down there with a laser measure and 100-foot tape measure and whatever I need and get the information. Some of the first mill, which was originally called Haywood Mills, is inaccessible now because over the years they've kind of filled in the spaces between the buildings to create inside access throughout the whole facility.
Yep.
Which in 1932 didn't exist. And of course, where I made the mistakes were in the places I didn't have access to. I couldn't get to.
Yep.
You know, I guessed and I guessed wrong. And, you know, one mistake cost me about 20 hours of redo work.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, which felt good. But I wanted it to be right. So that was one problem. The other problem is that the person that owns this particular mill isn't nice. In fact, she wants to kill me. I think she's coming around a little bit. But she doesn't fully understand why anybody would do something like this.
Sure.
And she's not particularly keen on having someone traipsing around the property with a tape measure and a camera.
Right.
And I get all of that.
You tell her you're not from OSHA, right?
Well, so here's the thing. This poor woman, she's in her 70s, and she is the owner of this. She's the third generation owner of this humongous building that is half empty. It's a fire trap. She can't lease out the space. She's trying to sell it. There's a little bit of an issue about, you know, is there a brownfield somewhere on the property? And she also had an issue with the Town Conservation Commission because there was, back in the day, the back portions of this mill were what they called the dye house.
Oh, yes.
So after they made the textiles, they brought them down to the dye house and ran them through the dye. And when there was a well that was dug to provide water to mix with the dry pigments for the dye. When they were done dyeing the material, they dumped it through an open hole in the concrete, which went into a sluiceway and out into wetlands.
Yeah. I'm actually, believe it or not, very familiar with that process because for many years I had a customer in Fall River that had three different plants in the city under various names doing exactly what you're describing.
Sure. Well, and the mill behind it, which is part of this project, also did the same thing, and they shared the same sluice way. And you can see the clay pipes.
Yep.
That fed the sluice way. Conversely, the people that own the mill behind it have been just the opposite. Whatever I need, any access I need, do whatever you want. I mean, I've been there with take measurements, and people have come out and say, "This is great. You know, we can't believe you're doing this. We can't wait to see it." It makes it worthwhile.
Have you shared any in progress pictures of it with the owner?
The first owner, no. Interestingly enough, that the town cable TV studio is doing a documentary on this whole thing, the two mills, and then the process of recreating it in miniature.
Oh.
So we want to interview the mill owners. So this woman, we'll call her Margaret Hamilton. If you think back to Wizard of Oz. Well, so anyway, we were shooting, the de facto town historian is involved in this project. So we were shooting the opening for this documentary. And we're standing on the abandoned Midland Division main line, which is adjacent to her building. And I'm literally between the gauge. And we're doing the opening.
No sign of tracks, though, right?
Oh, no, there's tracks there. They're just there. They store some ballast cars there. It's not an active main line.
Oh, wow. But so it connects to the outside world.
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. It's the line that goes from Franklin to Boston. So it's the old New Haven Midland Division.
Okay, but it's not like there's any rails into the mill, right?
Oh no.
Yeah.
No, there was they had one siding, you know, back in the day, and the siding served a loading dock and a coal trestle.
Gotcha.
So it was dual purpose. So we're shooting the opening, and the next thing I know, I hear, "Hello, can I help you?" And it's this woman, you know, come out to get us, chase us away with a shotgun. And no shotgun, I made that part up. And so I said, you know, "Margaret, it's me, Scott. You know, you've met me 100 times. We got talking, and I said, you know, have you thought more about being interviewed for this documentary? I don't have time for this. I can't do this. And I said, "Well," I said, that's fine. I said, "I've actually talked to some of your tenants, and they would be thrilled to be interviewed. Well, I don't want anyone telling my story." I said, "Well," then I guess, you know, that leaves it up to you then. "Well, I don't have time now, but talk to me after the summer." I said, "Fine, well, we're going to be shooting this for a while." So I said to the cameraman and this other guy, Joe, I said, "I think we're done for the night. Why don't we head back to our cars?" So we turn around. Turn our back to the mill, and we're walking back to our cars, and the cameraman says, "She just crawled through a window."
What?
And I turn, so there's no doors on that side of the mill. It's a, you know, track side.
Yeah.
And this woman, like I say, she's in her at least mid-70s. And I turn around, she's gone. Well, where the hell did she go? And the next thing I see is her closing the window behind her. She literally crawled through one of the mill windows. That's how she got out there, you know, to come after us.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's been one thing after another. I went down there one Saturday morning about 8 o'clock just to double check some measurements. My tires weren't in that parking lot for more than 30 seconds. And she was around the corner in her car. "Who are you and what are you doing here?" "Margaret, it's me, Scott." Just double checking some. My lawyer says you shouldn't be here. I said, "If you want me to leave, I'll leave." So it's been a process.
Wow.
Have
you brought her flowers?
I think they would wilt. I was a little reticent to meet with the people in the other mill because I'm thinking, if it's more of the same, it's just going to be depressing. So we made an appointment and went over there, and I had one of the annexes of this mill done already, and I brought it over, and I had a cloth over it covering it. And I took the cloth off, and they went, "Oh my God, this is," they were very impressed with it. And they gave me pictures, all the old pictures they had, which really shed some light on, because it
that stuff is gold.
Well, with a lot of these old mills, they're so overgrown now that you just can't get into parts of them.
Sure.
And so these pictures were, you know, taken at a time where that wasn't the case, and you can clearly see parts of the building that you can't see now. So anyway, the exhibit is due to go on display the beginning of December. There is some question as to whether that's a realistic deadline at this point.
Really?
Yeah. I'm spending every free moment I have working in my garage right now. And the first mill is getting close to being done. There are a lot of eccentricities to it. Their office building, which was a separate little gingerbread style house, the architect had to be on LSD when he designed this thing. It literally has a bay window that comes out of it, but the left hand side of it is curved. Like, why would you do that? Why did you feel like it had to be that fancy?
It was probably all curved and then repaired at one point.
Well, I've seen some pictures dating back to the 1800s when the first part of it was built, and it was curved. Jeez. It was always curved. So again, you know, we've invented some processes. The second mill, it's called Franklin Yarn, is it's a stucco building. Concrete and stucco building. And it's basically...
Now, you say concrete and stucco. Are you sure it's not just bricks that have been stuccoed over?
No. It is a concrete building. In fact, some of the ancillary buildings were the first use of cinder block.
Jeez.
Yeah. So we came up with this sandwich because the main mill is over 2 feet long. And again, it's all windows. So we started with a substrate of acrylic.
Okay.
1/8 inch acrylic. And we're layering 1/16 inch chipboard over it to create the outer facade of it. The windows and then the outer facade.
This is why you were asking me about gluing acrylic, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think because I'm just putting chipboard on it.
Acrylic would fall back on canopy glue.
Yeah, I think so too. Acrylic to acrylic, I think what I will do is use an interior corner brace and canopy glue it on, you know, two sides as opposed to just one weak joint.
Well, acrylic to acrylic, you can just, you know, use liquid cement for that, right?
I'm not sure. And it's an expensive experiment.
You don't have any pieces to test it on?
I will have.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, try it on smaller pieces and be satisfied with it and then start gluing up really large pieces of it and come to find out it's just weak.
Huh.
So
I kind of roof.
I'm sorry?
What are you using for the roof?
It'll be chipboard that's just heavily braced.
When you say chipboard, do you mean MDF?
No. It's the, you know, the paper, basically, the stuff you get in shirt boxes.
Shirt boxes.
I would go get a piece and hold it up for you, but with this is audio, you'd
like,
be the
like
only
high
one
quality
see.
Cardboard.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's been my de facto material for roofs for ages and ages anyway.
You threw me a curve there. I'm thinking shirts came in boxes.
Well, I mean, you're old enough to remember
that. How old
that.
Is this guy?
Well, you can get, I don't do a lot of dry cleaning anymore either, but you can have your shirts boxed at the dry cleaner.
Dry cleaners. Trying to think of the last thing I had dry cleaned.
I know.
My flannels are pretty easy to maintain.
Yeah. My t-shirts are holding up just great.
I'm wearing one right now.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. So we're cutting the second mill now.
So if you look at the project as a whole, you're not even at 50%, right?
No, I'm probably. Scenery always goes quickly for me.
Sure.
So I
think
say
the windows would be the slowest part.
Oh, the windows. So the windows,
because they're all sandwiched too, right?
They're three layers. Yeah, there's an upper sash, a lower sash, and a trim piece.
And it's not like you can mass produce them because of their differences.
Well, you can mass produce them in terms of, you know, laser cutting them in sheets for each window type.
You still have to build them by hand.
But you still have to build them by hand.
Right.
You know, you have to paint them. You have to glue them in. You know, you have to glaze them. So it's all a process.
Well, the glazing is when you put it up against the acrylic, though.
The acrylic is going to be cut out for the window openings because it's an eighth of an inch thick.
What is the acrylic for then? I thought you were using it for glazing.
The acrylic is just to give, because of the style of the building, we needed something to back it that wasn't going to warp.
I see.
So, you know, my original thought was, well, let's just get, you know, some eighth inch birch plywood. And
you'd have to use that aircraft plywood.
Yeah, and we did, and even the best stuff we could find still wasn't flat.
Really?
Yeah, and I just couldn't take that. And you can't.
This acrylic stuff is scribe and snap like styrene.
Yeah. So you know, and it's perfectly flat.
Yeah.
You don't have to brace it because it's not going to warp.
Some people have used plexiglass for the same kind of thing.
Well, it's the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
But it would have been too thick to use as the glazing.
And you used the laser to cut out the window openings in it?
Yes.
Huh, but that's a little bit of finagling so you don't melt it, right?
I can't speak to that. I own half the laser, but the laser is at Sam's house, which I'm very happy about, by the way. He has become a real expert with it. He spent a lot of time just with all the various materials that we've cut, just figuring out power and speed and making sure that we've got the right mix. We're not burning things. We're not, you know, not cutting all the way through things, which is a pain in the neck, especially when you work on the chipboard.
It's like having your own little private Jimmy Simmons.
Well, I mean, there's no way I would have been able to do this project without his help.
Yep.
We wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
But
I would say from a reasoning of the reason you're doing it, this scratches your ever-present structure building itch, correct?
Well, it does. It serves a couple of purposes, and that's one of them. But the other piece too is it feeds my love of history.
Mm.
So this building was at the confluence of the New Haven's Midland Division Main Line and the Midland Division Milford branch. And it was the last piece that they built actually was wedge shaped so that it could accommodate the tracks going off to Milford on the right hand side of the building. And it's just a neat kind of multi-level building on a varying grade.
You really enjoyed the research on this too.
Oh, the research was fantastic. I had you know, people that were essential in providing me information that was helpful. But again, if that building didn't exist today, I couldn't build it. It was too vast and too intricate.
You'd have to use some license, you know, some artistic license.
I would have had to use probably 50%. artistic license.
Right.
So now all I have to do is just, you know, go down there with my running shoes on and my Kevlar vest and, you know, hope I don't get arrested for trespassing. But, and I, you know, I hope when all is said and done. So, you know, you know, I said to her, I'm just trying to, this is your family's legacy, and I'm just trying to capture it for, you know, for posterity. And I hope when all is said and done that you know, everybody appreciates it.
Now, is everything you've built in the past on display also, or do the displays alternate?
So these three dioramas will all be on display at the same time. And the exhibit is supposed to run from the first weekend in December until the last weekend in January.
Well, I'm talking about the stuff you made in past years.
Yes.
Where is that?
Well, it's in storage now. So the DPW in town was kind enough to take the two crates and bring them to their warehouse and hold on to them. Because that was one of the big challenges, and that was also one of the challenges we had to overcome with the size of this diorama. If I build it, how do we store it?
Right.
Because it doesn't, I certainly don't have room for it in my house.
Even transportation is an issue.
Well, and that's the other great thing. You know, the DPW shows up with a couple of trucks, and you know, they'll show up with a truck here. I've got a couple of friends who are going to build an industrial size crate for this thing, load it onto the truck and bring it over to the museum and along with the other two and set them up. They'll take the crates away. And then when it's time to go off exhibit, I'll crate them back up and they'll come get the crates and take them back to storage for me.
But the exhibit season is 1 month a year?
It's 2 months.
2 months.
December and January.
So what happens if you don't make December?
I have to move.
Will you display what you've built so far?
I think probably what will happen is we will postpone this exhibit until this piece of it is done, and we will display all three pieces.
So it could be January, February.
Right.
I see.
Right. Yep. I don't. We've got a number of revolving exhibits that we do every year, and then some new exhibits that we splice into that mix. So, you know, to display the two existing pieces and then at a later date display the new one would take up a chunk of the calendar that you know, I would feel a little selfish in doing that.
No, I think your plan makes sense. I would actually like to see it myself, you know, when you get all of this done and announced.
Yeah, no.
Ready. So
no.
In January, I've got another grandchild scheduled to parachute in, but I'll bet I can make some time to get up there.
Well, one of the things that we've done in conjunction with this, and again, we've got this documentary that's going to be coming out probably in February. It'll be after this goes on exhibit.
How will one be able to see that? Will it be on YouTube or something?
Yes, it will. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, maybe that's something we talk about, you know, or at least I post about on the Facebook page.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say one thing you've got to do now is you've got to put up a couple pictures at least.
Yeah. And I will.
Give us a taste.
You know, I'm a little reticent about showing work in progress, but
you know why that is. I would have no articles if I felt that way.
You know what, Mike, you know, you're right. I dislike my work until about the 11th hour.
You are.
And then it's like, I look at, I'm like, all right, I'm okay with this now.
People love work in process stuff because it shows the steps and the stages and everybody feels like that. So if they look at what an accomplished guy's stuff looks like at different stages, makes them feel a little better about, you know, what they're doing too.
Well, and maybe if they just saw my stuff, they'd feel better too.
This is a public service.
Is that what we're doing?
That's it. Gotta give back now.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the report. You know, last weekend it was Labor Day weekend. I had 3 days in the garage. It was fantastic. I got a ton done.
Well, the break in the weather must have been something.
Oh, and that's the other
thing.
I had an exhaust fan down there just, you know, trying to clear out some of the heat.
Jeez.
And
when I was working in Florida with my son down there, the heat index was I think around 105 or 106, something like that. And the project that we were doing, because it was a two-man thing, was building a fence to his old fence that he had bought the house that it had. It was just there was nothing straight about it, and all of the posts were rotted at the bottom, and the only thing you could do is rip it out and do it right. So I said, you know, I'll bet we can knock this off while I'm here. But what we had to do was, and I'd never really worked in these conditions, he set up he called it a pop-up tent. You know, it's just something that goes up very quickly and it's pretty good size. That gave us some shade. And then he had these big floor-mounted industrial fans. And believe it or not, that's really what saved us. And we would work for about 45 minutes. My head was dripping like it does when it's under the shower head. I mean, ridiculous. Yeah, yeah. And we'd work for 45 minutes, down a can of cold, and then and go right back at it again. So
wow,
I think he was impressed that the old guy was still able to do that.
Well, it's
I know
it's,
I was.
It's good that you can, and you know you had mentioned that you know body parts were falling off you, and you know, but that kind of belays that indication.
Well, you know, I've always been somebody who does things. I'm a doer. I like to do things, like the old Dunkin' commercial. Doing things is what we like to do. Yeah. So the duty cycle isn't what it used to be. So, you know, instead of working like, you know, 12 hours straight on something, I might go six.
Yeah.
And the next day, parts will hurt a lot sometimes. I've noticed this year, starting to feel it in my hands, you know, like the central tendons in the middle of your hand, they go to the big knuckle.
Yeah.
Both hands are just like, will just ache, you know, afterwards or the next morning or whatever. So, and I had to have a heart to heart with my podiatrist about my footwear. I'm wearing very different footwear now. And I've got these not inexpensive, but incredible inserts in all of my shoes now, even my slippers. And that's changed everything for my feet. People would say to me, well, how long's an obsession for you guys? You know, typically. And I'd say, Dave and I usually operate till our feet hurt. And then he goes home.
Yeah.
Now it's not so bad. You know, I'm starting to get a hold of that, but you know, I'm a friend with the Aleve.
Yeah. Yeah.
More often than I normally would be.
Well, and this is my 13th season in this baseball league.
What you're doing there is not something a 60-something-year-old should be doing.
Well, what's interesting for me is that, again, it's all a series of challenges, right? Problem solving. So how do I continue to pitch at a high level year over year as I continue to age? And I really, honestly, because I had some pretty bad elbow issues going into this season.
Is there anybody your age still pitching?
There are a few. But I've been very lucky, Mike. I've played on very good teams. I'm not a strikeout pitcher. I'm a what's called a pitch to contact.
Pitch to contact, pitcher. Absolutely. So you've got some good defense behind you.
So I need to have a good defense behind me in order to succeed. But coming into the season, I was stuck at 89 wins. I had 89 wins in this league since 2012. And so, you know, the way my brain works, all right, well,
you gotta go for 100, Scott.
How do I get to 100?
Yeah.
And, you know, as I'm thinking this, my elbow is just, I've been to so many specialists about this elbow and they weren't sure if it was a partial UCL tear or just really bad tendonitis. And,
Doc, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, stop doing that. Yeah. And So, you know, I'm the assistant coach on this team too. And the head coach and I talked it over and he said, well, you know, why don't you just become the closer this year? You know, we won't put a lot of heavy duty on you. We recruited a couple of really good pitchers, took the pressure off me anyway. So I said, all right, I'll be the closer. So I closed a couple of games, and you know,
can get
summer
saves,
comes,
but not necessarily wins, right?
Right, no wins. So summer comes around, and you know, next thing you know, guys are starting to take vacations, and you know, the guy that one of the starting pitchers can't show up. So all right, well, I'll start a game and see how far I can go. Well, you know, if you're going to go four innings, you might as well go five and at least qualify for the win.
Sure.
So I ended up, we just had our last regular season game Thursday night. We start playoffs next week, but I ended up 4-0. So I got 93 wins now.
Okay.
And I'll probably get another start in the playoffs. But interestingly enough, when I won my 90th game, the commissioner of the league showed up for the next game. And he said, hey, he said, you know, I want to talk to you. And he said, you know, congratulations. He said, you know, 90 is a big deal. And I said, well, you know, there's other great pitchers in this league. I, you know, Oil Can Boyd pitched in this league for a number of years, and, you know, several other former minor league and major league pitchers. And he said, no, he said, you have 34 more wins than the next guy.
So your record is safer than Shula's.
I get, well, you know, on that level, I guess it is, but, and I'm just thrilled. Yeah, I pitched seven innings Tuesday night, and my shoulder, I can't, the folks at home can't, who are listening can't see this, but this is how high I can lift my shoulder right now without screaming in agony. But my elbow, which was the problem, doesn't hurt at all.
How do
so
you
for whatever,
that? You just transferred the stress to your shoulder?
But my shoulder has always hurt since day one. I figured out, it's a formula, right? So here's the problem solved. I went for a deep tissue massage an hour and a half before I had to be at the field Tuesday
okay,
night.
Okay, yeah.
I was so loose. It took me two innings to kind of rein it in a little bit.
Really?
Because I was kind of overthrowing a little bit. But once the catcher got me settled down, we had a pretty easy night of it. But
is that something that you feel like you might do now? Before games?
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like massages anyway, but
I think in my case I'm running into tendon issues. I think that's what the, you know, down the middle of the hand thing is. And I've got elbow issues. I have to stop playing tennis because of that, you know. So
that's my big fear.
I have crummy tendons, I think.
You know, arthritis in our hands. I mean, that wouldn't be good for us, you know, based
exactly
on what we do.
I need to, you know, I need to type, you know, I need to be able to do things.
Yeah. You need to be able to hold an X-Acto knife.
Exactly. So I think that the fine stuff will probably be the last to go, but that's why I was saying, you know, the heavy duty, you know, you're using an impact screw gun 400 times in a row.
Yeah,
I'd like to get the rest of the layout, bench work, and what have you, you know,
I don't blame
place
you.
Sooner than later, you know.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
And,
yep.
and assuming I have a healthy 70s, then I've got my 70s to do all the little stuff I want to do.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Well, you know, we're all waiting with bated breath here. To see how Crestwood fleshes out, and
I think it's just going to be another fun project.
I
you know, people have often asked me, "What's your favorite thing about model railroading? What do you like to do the most?" And my honest answer is always everything. I thoroughly enjoy every aspect of model railroading. Maybe not so much like cleanup after a project. I've never been. I've never been the kid that wants to put his toys away.
Yep. I don't know.
I try to be better with tools now because, boy, do I waste time looking for tools if I don't do that.
Yep. Yep. I hear you.
I do want to, before we part, just give a shout out to my loyal Dartmouth Locomotive Works customers who have been very nice about being willing to wait.
Yeah, that's a blessing.
And when people send me stuff and say, no rush, get to it when you get to it, I try not to abuse that. But invariably, it probably goes longer than it should. I will say the fall and winter is coming, and I should be able to, you know, clean up my backlog in pretty short order. Fortunately, supplies of Loxone decoders and speakers are very, very good right now. So I think I'm the limitation, but I'll get back on it. This summer, I had a lot of fish in the fryer later, and it wasn't that.
Sure. Goes without saying. It happens.
All right. So I'm going to admonish you. Put a couple of pictures in the group because people want to see what you were talking about, even if it's just a couple, a little taste.
All right. I'll tell you what. I'm gonna go down there now. I'm gonna take some pictures. I've also got a stack of pictures of the prototype. So I'll kind of do a comparison of that, the model versus.
That's useful too. What you're aiming for. So absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep.
So I'll take them tonight. I'll post them tomorrow, and then you can get off my back.
Yeah, and I would thank you for being on mine. I don't think we would have had a podcast this month without you. So I'm going to give you full credit for that.
The good old days.
Yeah. It's like riding a bike, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's always good to talk to you.
All right, Scott. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.